amazing story in the Old Testament. It's an incident. It happened while the Israelites were on their way from Egypt to the Promised Land, to the land of Canaan. While they were there, they kind of rebelled against God, and in those circumstances, Moses prayed for them. God forgave their sin, but Moses wanted something more. I mean, he had already been meeting with God and hearing from God for quite a few weeks at this point, if not months. But it was always hearing from God, but he never actually saw God face to face. So he was in quite good terms with God. So at this point he says, God, I want to see you. I just want to see you, okay? Which is understandable. I'd like to see God. So Moses says, God, we are such good friends. So how about I get to see you? What was God's answer? He says, Moses, that's just not possible. Nobody can see me and live. It's just not possible for a human, mortal human, to see me and live. But I'm going to do something for you. And this is what it says. God says to Moses, there is a place near me where you may stand on a rock. When my glory passes by, I will put you in a cleft in the rock and cover you with my hand until I have passed by. Then I will remove my hand and you will see my back, but my face must not be seen. This is exactly what happens in Exodus 34. God walks by, covers Moses' face while he goes by. When he's passed, takes the hand away, and Moses can see the back of God as God walked in front of him. Now, obviously, they have this conversation. Moses goes down, but when he goes down, something interesting happens. People started running away from him. Can you imagine that? You go downstairs in the mountain, and people go like, oh, okay, I don't want to talk to you. Why were people running away from Moses? What was wrong with him? He's just seen God. Why were they running away from him? Anybody? Yes? Yes. When Moses came down from Mount Sinai with the two tablets of the covenant law in his hands, he was not aware that his face was radiant because he had spoken with the Lord. When Aaron and all the Israelites saw Moses, his face was radiant and they were afraid to come near him. We were singing earlier about the mountaintop, okay? When you hear, by the way, if you are new to church, okay, or maybe not a Christian, when you hear Christians talking about mountaintop experience, this is one of the texts that they refer to. Namely, the mountaintop experience means you have been in the presence of God. You have had that experience. You experienced His glory, His beauty, His light, and your heart was warmed up by that experience. That's a mountaintop experience, and you begin to shine. By the way, do you know somebody else in the Bible who had a similar experience and then his face was shining? Jesus, the same experience, okay? Just like Moses, Jesus on the mountaintop meets God and his face starts shining and even his clothes changed. But there is an interesting point here, namely, when we spend time in God's presence, guess what's going to happen to us? Maybe not our faces, although even our faces. You look at certain people like, there's something special in these people's eyes. One of my colleagues at work, I was talking to him. I thought, there's something special with this man. I discovered that he was a Christian. There was a certain light on his face. I was like, oh, okay, Christian, good. Oh. You see, when you stay in God's presence, you begin to express His attributes. And we read about one of His attributes, 1 John 4:8. I have read this verse many times. I'm not going to read it. I'm just going to ask you what it says, 1 John 4:8. Okay? It says that God is... Oh dear, were you not listening last Sunday when I was preaching? When Alistair was preaching. And okay, you're just too shy. Remember that when I ask questions, I actually want answers. God is... love. You're not convinced. Not sure. God is love. He is. He actually is love. God is love. When we spend time in His presence, we begin to show that love towards other people. And last Sunday, we saw that we need to express that love towards who? Just look around. Towards our brothers and sisters in Christ. Towards each other. We need to show love to each other. And Jesus says that if you spend time in God's presence, you are going to love God first of all, and you are going to love your neighbor. Now, when I said brothers and sisters, that's not really all our neighbors. It's just those who believe like us. But Jesus says, your neighbor. So who exactly is my neighbor? Is it the person living next to me on the street? Is it the person sat next to me at work? Is it the person sat next to me in train, maybe? Who exactly is my neighbor? Have your Bibles open to Luke chapter 10 from verse 27, because 25 actually. We're going to refer to that one. You see, there's a conversation between Jesus and an expert in the law. And the expert in the law had a question, right? He asked Jesus, what is the greatest command? And Jesus says, well, the greatest command is love God and love your neighbor. And he says, who's my neighbor? Why did he ask that question? Look at verse 29. He wanted to justify himself. What do you think that means? He wanted to justify himself. What exactly was he asking in asking, who's my neighbor? Jesus, how many people do I have to love? Or to put it the other way, how many people do I not have to love? If you could give me a narrow definition of my neighbor, I'd be very pleased, because I'm already a teacher of the law. I'm already a good person. I already love my family, and I love my children, and I love my wife, and I love all mine. Okay? All these four categories, I love them. Okay? As for the other people, so could you please confirm to me that my neighbor is just the people I already love? And those unlovable, unloving people, they cannot be my neighbor. See the context? So he wanted a very narrow definition of the neighbor so that he can boast. And Jesus, you know, I just love how Jesus answers questions. He didn't just say, well, this person is your neighbor. Instead, he gives a parable. Okay? We call it the parable of the Good Samaritan. Let's have another look at this parable, starting in verse 30. In reply, Jesus said, a man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho when he was attacked by robbers. They stripped him of his clothes, beat him, and went away, leaving him half dead. A priest happened to be going down the same road, and when he saw the man, he passed by on the other side. So too a Levite. When he came to the place, he saw him pass by on the other side. But the Samaritan, as he traveled, came where the man was, and when he saw him, he took pity on him. He went to him and bandaged his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. Then he put the man on his own donkey, brought him to an inn, and took care of him. The next day he took out 2 denarii and gave them to the innkeeper. Look after him, he said, and when I return, I will reimburse you for any extra expense you may have. Now, that's the story. Okay? For us, well, it's just a story, but just put a bit on the glasses of a Jew in the first century. It's a story about the Samaritan. By the way, if you think of Israel today, if you were to think of who this Samaritan might be in current day Israel, who do you think they might consider Samaritans today? Palestinians, okay? If Jesus was living today, he gave a story. So there was this Palestinian, and when they heard the word Palestinian, okay, what kind of story can you say about Palestinians? Like, okay, what kind of story can you say about a Samaritan? So we have this Samaritan in Israelite territory, okay? What do we know about this Samaritan? Was he there for pleasure? Was he there on business? We don't really know, but remember that Samaritans and Jews, they didn't get along with each other, so I doubt that he was there for pleasure. And I doubt he went to the temple to worship, because they wouldn't worship at the temple. They thought that they should be worshiping on their mountain. Is he rich? Is he poor? Probably the fact that he owns a donkey doesn't mean too much for us, like a donkey. But in those days, to have a donkey was a big thing. It's like, having a Ferrari today. Okay, you had a donkey. And this man, maybe notice that he paid 2 denarii, which was 2 days' wages. So that was quite a lot of money in those days. So you get this picture, okay? You have a wealthy Samaritan who was hated by the Jews. He was walking there on the streets and sees this man that's half dead on the floor. Okay? What do you think, what kind of thoughts crossed his mind at some point when he saw that man down? Did he have any natural inclination to think, oh, this person is my neighbor? Probably what crossed his mind was something like this. I'm a Samaritan. He's a Jew. He probably hates me. Samaritans and Jews have no business with each other. He, even this Jew, has a different religion and will consider me unclean. He'd probably be offended if I touched him. He's definitely not my neighbor. He could have said that. His definition of neighbor could be very narrow, and he could just walk by. And yet, that's not what he's thinking. How do we know that? Because he approaches that person and helps him. So, back to our question, who's my neighbor? That's what the teacher of the law asked. And Jesus gives this story. So, who's my neighbor? What's the definition of the neighbor? Well, I think this is the definition that I gave. Any fellow human, irrespective of their nationality, race, color, political affiliation, education, or even religion, is my neighbor. Based on this definition, how many neighbors have we got? They are still counting, but it's about 7.5 billion, I think. Every person on earth is my neighbor. How about that definition of a neighbor? I'm convinced that the teacher of the law was really sorry that he even asked this question. Like, what was in my mind? Why did I ask him? Oh, I should have expected this from him. He made the Samaritan the hero of the story. He made me look bad. That's really, really bad for me. But I think that Jesus answering with a parable, he didn't just want to point as to who is my neighbor. But I think in this parable, he also wants to explain what's involved in loving our neighbor. Because, as we saw last week, it's quite easy to say we love our neighbor. I just love my neighbor. Anybody ask me, do you love your neighbor? Yeah, I love my neighbor. Okay. But Jesus says, if you really love your neighbor, that's going to show. And in the story, he points out to a few things, and I think one of the things he points out is that loving others is costly. Loving others is costly. It just costs you to show love to other people. Have another look at verses 33 and 34. But the Samaritan, as he traveled, came where the man was. And when he saw him, he took pity on him. He went to him and bandaged his wounds. Have you noticed that? You know, helping others can be a distraction from our own goal. As I said, this man probably was a businessman and was going his own way. Maybe he finished his business. Maybe he was going towards to finish the business, but he had to stop. And it cost him his time. No wonder that the Levite and the priest did not want to stop, and it cost him his plans. The Samaritan was going somewhere. He had to put his own plans on the back burner and attend to this person. So he had to go out of his own way, quite literally, to be able to go to this person and attend to his needs. When we want to help others, that will cost us. What? Well, time. It may even ruin our plans. I might be late to wherever I'm going, and I might not even get there. And if we keep reading, we see that he went on to him and bandaged his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. Now, honestly, this to me sounds more like a salad dressing than anything else. Oil and wine, okay? But obviously, those of you who are familiar with the first century, you know that wine was quite good as a disinfectant, you know, put in the wound and cleanse it. And then oil would help healing. By the way, it even works today, okay? If you want to try it. So, in other words, he takes something that he had and uses for this person. A bit further, we see that he gave out two denarii gave to the innkeeper and promised some more. So it didn't just cost him his time and his plans, but actually it cost him his resources. He had to use stuff that he had, his belongings, his money, to be able to help this person. So when you think that helping others may cost you your time, your plans, and your resources, can you really judge the priest and the Levites that went there? We don't know what their plans were. Have you noticed that the story mentions that they were going down from Jerusalem? Does that ring a bell from you, that the Levite and the priest were going down from Jerusalem? As it happens, the Levites and the priests would not necessarily live in Jerusalem. They might live somewhere else, in Jericho, for example, and commute to Jerusalem for work. And they had to work in Jerusalem. One shift was 1 week. So they had to leave their families behind, go to Jerusalem, serve in the temple for 1 week, and now they are on the way home. It's me on my train commute back, okay? When I'm tired after a day at work, all I want is to lie down, okay? Not really, I'm not that tired. But anyhow, I'm saying that for those of you who are tired after a day at work. Coming down, you don't want to have your family time ruined, okay? I need to see my wife, I need to see my children, I don't want to stop. Can you really blame them? Can you judge them for not wanting to stop and ruin their time and everything else after 1 week at work? Cannot really judge them. Because if I were to judge them, I'm afraid I might judge myself. Because I'm not a lot better. So Jesus says, you need to love God, but you also need to love those around you. 7.5 billion of them. And it's interesting that Paul picks up on these words in Galatians 6:10, where he says, therefore, as we have opportunity, let us do good to all people. Doesn't sound a bit of a daunting job? All people? 7.5 billion? There's not enough seconds in a day to do that. But I like the way Paul puts it. Therefore, as we have opportunity. It's not every day that this happens, but sometimes I might have an opportunity. It might cost time, it might cost my plans, my resources, but I might just have an opportunity. And then I have to make that decision. Do I walk by or do I stop? Sometimes such opportunities maybe happen once a week, once a month, once a year. I don't know. But I might just walk by and see somebody. Do I keep walking? Do I stop? I don't know what needs they have. And since I mentioned that we need to love our neighbor and to attend to their needs, I think it would be a bit of injustice to the whole New Testament if I just stop with their material needs. And it's true that as a Christian, I need to do good to all people and try to attend as much as I can, as much as I have possibility and opportunity, to attend to their material needs. And if you wish, this is called, probably could be called as the social gospel. As a Christian, I want to be good to my neighbor. As a Christian, I want to help my neighbor. As a Christian, I want to be there for them and get involved with the needs they have. Unfortunately, sometimes churches and Christians stop just here. But have we really done a good job loving our neighbor if we only focus on their physical and material needs? You see, the greatest good you could do to somebody is to do what? To save their lives. If somebody is drowning, or if somebody is in a burning building, or somebody is in a danger of losing their lives, it's just the best thing you could do for them, to save their lives. And I was thinking, you know, we don't really save their lives, we just extend their lives just a little bit longer. Eventually they will still die. This is why we need to remember that the most important way to show love to the world around us is to make them aware of the love of God. John 3:16 says that the greatest show of love on God's side was what? Sending his son. And you look at Jesus. Did he do good to people? Yes, he did. He healed people and he helped people. And sometimes it goes unnoticed. But did you notice that Jesus used to make donations to the poor? Did you notice that? Because it's in the context when he speak about Judas, that he had the bag, and when he said, do what you have to do, they thought Jesus said to give some money to the poor. So Jesus had the habit not just to heal people, but actually make donation from their purse to make donation to the poor. Was part of what it meant for them to be Jews and obey the law of Moses. Yet the greatest show of love was not his healings and even resurrections or anything. Was dying for our sins. And you know, when we look at the story of the Good Samaritan, it's probably easy for us to feel pity for the man. You know, you can actually imagine that person, being beaten and there's there, it's almost dying, and the Levite and the priest just don't show any mercy, and we kind of feel like we could condemn these people walking past and feeling no mercy. But what if the person who was robbed was actually robbed spiritually? Imagine all the people that walk past us, that live in our neighborhood, and they just look all right to us. They are not at the side of the road. They seem to have a good life. Yet inside they are empty. They are empty because these people have been robbed by Satan of a relationship with God. These people have been robbed by Satan from that opportunity to spend eternity with God, to inherit everything God has. If my neighbor was robbed and everything, all his possessions were taken away from his home, I feel very sorry for him. I'll try to help him. But when I know that his eternal possessions have been robbed from him by Satan, when I know that my neighbor is going to spend eternity away from God, how does that add up? Maybe it's not easy to see that. But we need to open our spiritual eyes to realize that our neighbor have been robbed. And just as this person was in a dire condition there, they're in the same situation. And I remember I listened to the testimony of this pastor in the days when he was a young man at university. It is not a Christian university. It was a secular university. And he took this course in public speaking. So he sat in a class, they taught him about public speaking, and towards the end of the year he had to have an exam. And what exam meant was he had to stand in front of his class and give a public speech. Okay? Because he was a Christian, and because many of his colleagues were not Christians, guess what he decided to talk about? And says, why should I waste this opportunity? I'm going to preach Jesus. So he stood in front of the class and he explained how people can be saved and everything. And he was quite proud of himself of preaching the gospel. But at the end of his 5-10 minute speech, the class was allowed to ask questions. So this young lady stood at the back of the class and she had a question. And the question was like this. So are you saying that all of us, unless we believe what you just said, we are going to spend eternity in hell when we die? She wasn't very happy with his lecture. Okay, that was a bit of shock for him. And he said, well, I've never been asked such things in such a blunt way. And he started sweating. And he said, well, sin separates us from God, and if we die in that condition, then yeah, we're going to be separated from Him for forever and ever. So if you don't accept Jesus, yeah, you will go to hell. That didn't end well. He wasn't really the favorite of the class at the end of that school year. But after the presentation, this young lady came to him and said, that's the most hateful and arrogant thing I've ever heard. Just because we don't believe what you believe, it doesn't mean that we all be damned. She turned her back to him, went away. Okay. But remember, she was his classmate. So in the next few weeks, she kept coming back with questions. But she wasn't really listening for the answer that he was trying to give, answers from the Bible. But no, she was just shooting question after question after question to make him feel bad. Thankfully, for him, it was the end of the school year. They broke for holidays and he had a bit of peace. When the school year resumed, okay, went back to school, sat at the back of the class and went to the first lecture. And that person, his colleague, she was sat at the front. So at some point, she turned around and she saw him and told him, I need to talk to you after class. We're like, great, yes. Oh, okay. So she did meet him after the class, and he said, I wasn't really looking forward to talking to this person who had just called me hateful and arrogant. But after the class, she said, I want you to know that this summer I found out that Jesus is the only way to forgive my sins, and now I know that if I die, I go to heaven. Just as that. Okay. And I was thinking, you know, this person, she was convinced, she had a good life, she was convinced, is everything good, until this hateful Christian told her that she needs Jesus. And that shook her. During the summer, she went actually to a camp, she met an evangelist, and she became Christian herself. And that changed. The pastor concluded with this. He said, it would be arrogant and hateful to tell someone that they go to hell if they don't believe in Jesus. It would be, unless it's true. But if it is true, the most arrogant and hateful thing we can do is keep this to ourselves. I mean, how much do you have to hate someone to know that they can be saved from sin and its consequences, yet say nothing to them? My time is up. I'll finish. But I want to finish and say that these two things need to be kept in balance. Okay? I need to keep in balance doing good and helping people with their physical and material needs and everything else, with helping them spiritually. And you know what happens when I help people materially? That might just open the door for helping them spiritually as well. That's why the balance is needed. We walk daily past people who have been robbed. Maybe people have been robbed of their health, or maybe their money, or maybe their spiritual relationship with God. So while we finish, why don't we have a time of meditation and maybe open prayer if you wish. And the way I would approach this time of prayer is to think, who is my neighbor? Out of 7.5 billion of people, who is that person next to me that needs me? Maybe my neighbor, maybe someone at school, at work, someone that I can show to them love in a practical way. Maybe somebody has a need. Maybe it's not even a material need. Maybe just need somebody to listen to them, somebody to encourage them, somebody to do something for them, something kind to them. But also it might be somebody that I need to share the gospel with. Who is my neighbor? I want to be a good Samaritan. Who's my neighbor who needs me? Let's meditate on this one. And after a time of meditation, if you want to pray aloud, feel free to do so.